Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Welcome to the Daily Jungle. It is a podcast Tuesday, so not a moment to waste. The Eagles are the only 6-1 team in the NFL. The World Series kicks off tonight. A couple of 100-win teams and 100-degree weather here in Los Angeles. The Eagles are the only 6-1 team in the NFL, and the World Series kicks off tonight. Two 100-win teams in 100-degree weather here in L.A. And Alvin freaking DeLauro just sledgehammered Ryan from New Mexico for having the audacity to correct us when we got his name wrong on air. And we had three great guests. Wide receiver David Sills from West Virginia, author John Feinstein, and the mayor, Sean Casey. Alvin, if you've washed all the blood off your hands, what do you say that you be so as kind to just go ahead and roll it? Now, you know it's a bad sign when I'm checking on Browns fans the morning after a game that they did not play. But from now on, that's how it's going to go every single time Carson Wentz has a monster game. And he had a monster game last night. Stop me if you've heard this before, but you guys could have had that guy. You know, the guy who went 17 for 25 for 268 yards and four touchdowns and led both teams in rushing with 63 yards last night. The guy who leads the NFL in touchdown passes. The guy who set a franchise record for most TD passes in the first seven games of a season. The guy who has his team at 6-1 and is on top of the MVP race at the very moment. You could have had that guy. Instead, you have Cody Kessler, DeShone Kizer, and 22 losses in the last 23 games. Hey, look, I'm not going to give up on Kizer just yet, but he hasn't exactly made that trade look like a win for the Browns. In fact, nothing has looked like a win for the Browns, aside from that one game that they actually won last season. But this is not all about what the Browns didn't or couldn't do. It's about what Wentz is doing, because he is doing special things. That's a special player. How many times did it look like he was going to be sacked, only to slip the tackle and make a play, as he did on this amazing play in the third quarter last night?
Wentz gets the shotgun snap, drops back three, rush comes on, breaks the tackle, throws a pass as he's hit, in the end zone, it's a backpedaling, falling down, chest high catch, touchdown, corner of the end zone, Clement, 9-yard touchdown.
That's Westwood One, and I still have no idea how he made that play. I still have no idea how he made that happen. He should have been sacked well before he got rid of it, and yet he still makes this amazing throw. Wentz was good last year, but he's bordering on great this year, and it's only his second season. And how about that third down play early in the fourth quarter when it looked like he was going to be taken down, except he never was? The one that even fooled safety Malcolm Jenkins, who saw the start of the play, and then walked back to the bench to get his helmet, only to glance up at the video board and see, quote, he was still running. That's the magic of Carson Wentz.
Shotgun snap is belt high. Drops back three. Pocket crumbles. He'll go down. No, he escapes. He runs out of no place. The 30, the 40, up the middle he goes. Running along the hash mark. He sprints to the 44. He is Houdini. 17-yard run. How did he get free? Squirming free for a first down run for Philadelphia.
I mean, it's got a sting, right? C-Town, the magic of Carson Wentz. When was the last time anybody in Browns gear was referred to as magic? But it wasn't just magical. According to Nelson Aguilar, it was, quote, amazing. We didn't know how he did that. Three, four plays later, we were still on the sideline trying to figure out how he did that, end quote. Hell, even his coach, Doug Peterson, said that Carson is nothing like he's ever seen before.
He played extremely well tonight. He understands, you know, the game plan. Listen, he studies and prepares like I've never seen before in a quarterback.
And it's not just his teammates. LeSean McCoy, of all people, hopped on Twitter to say, quote, sheesh, Carson, super nice. And you know, Shady is not exactly going out of his way to hype an Eagle, any Eagle, for any reason. But it's really hard not to hype this guy after last night. And you have to keep reminding yourself, it's only his 23rd NFL start. So you don't want to get too amped too early. But it is still only his 23rd NFL start. And if he's playing the way he played last night, in primetime against a divisional rival, how much better is he still going to get? And how do you even begin to explain that? How do you not get hyped when you see what this guy does and what he doesn't do? The fact that he doesn't freak out, the fact that he's so composed, the fact that he's in such control in pressure situations. The guy practically iced the division title in mid-October, and he hasn't even played two full seasons. Now, that doesn't mean that he's the greatest quarterback ever. It doesn't even mean that he's the best quarterback in the NFC right now. But it sure as hell looks like he is. I don't know if he'll be the MVP, but if I had to vote right now, I'd give that to him too. And I know this, he's better than anybody Cleveland has right now or has had for decades. And they could have had him. Except Cleveland thought they were smarter than everybody else, only to outsmart themselves again. And they're not smarter than everybody else, just worse than everybody else. And every touchdown pass this guy throws, every sack he escapes, is going to be a little more salt in the wounds for Cleveland. Because he could have been yours, but he's not. He's Philly's, and they can't get enough of him. Eagle fan, reaction! How hyped are you? How psyched are you to see Carson Wentz and your team? Best record in the NFL, arguably the best player on the best team in the NFL. Guy looks incredible. We are joined by West Virginia receiver David Sills. First to ask you about that first TD against Baylor. That was a ball when you went up over the DB. You came down with it. Randy Moss gave you a shout out for that play. First off, can you take me through the play? What did you see? And then what's it like having one of the all-time great wideouts giving you some love for it?
That's awesome recognition, you know, just watching Randy Moss grow up and, you know, all the plays he's made, you know, in the NFL and in college. But, you know, our coach Holgerson has really challenged us to make plays, you know, in contested plays at that. So, you know, my quarterback Will gave me a great opportunity to go make a play. So that's really what I tried to do for, the offense and the team. You know, we've really been challenged to just try to make contested plays. And, when the ball's in the air, we got to go make a play. So that's just what I tried to do and ended up coming down with it.
David Sills, wide receiver for West Virginia, joining us. You mentioned your quarterback, Will. That's Will Greer. Now, from the outside, it seems like you and he have amazing chemistry, even though you've only been together for less than a year. You texted him when you came back from El Camino College to say that anytime he wanted to work, you were ready. So how have you been able to get on the same page so quickly? And then how would you describe the relationship that the two of you have?
Yeah, I mean, right when I came back, you know, I told him I was ready to work, quarterback 100% behind me, and I was ready to, you know, be a better receiver and really just work as hard as I could, to be the best receiver that I could. So as soon as I came back, you know, he took me up on that, and we threw, all winter, all spring, all summer. And, you know, it wasn't just me. It was all the receivers out there. We were working as a unit and just getting timing down with Will. But, you know, over that time, we also continue to grow in our friendship and, get closer off the field and hang out and everything like that. So, you know, I think our friendship off the field has also, kind of gone into our connection on the field and everything. You know, when he's, in the offensive coordinator, Coach Spav's office, watching film and game planning, you know, week to week, I try to go in there, sit in and see what they're thinking so that, you know, when I'm out there on the field, you know, I'm kind of seeing the same thing he's seeing and thinking the same thing that he's thinking. So that's, you know, just kind of how, our relationship has been, since I got back here, but also going through the season and everything.
West Virginia wide receiver David Sills joining us. Now, David, as some people recall, you made national news when you committed to USC as a seventh grade quarterback. As you look back on that time, what kind of thoughts do you have? For instance, did you think it would be as big a deal as everybody made it out to be?
Looking back on it now, that was what I wanted to do at the time. That was, where my heart was. I was where, I wanted to play college football. But, you know, there's a lot of things that changed from seventh grade. A lot of different circumstances happened. Just ending up coming to West Virginia. I love the coaching staff here, loved everything about the WVU tradition and everything like that. So, You know, I just fell in love with the place and felt like WVU was the right place for me. And, you know, I don't look at committing to USC at a young age as a mistake or anything. You know, I kind of just embrace it and, you know, really try to, you know, kind of live up to whatever the expectations were of, you know, people thinking things about me and everything like that. So now I'm just playing receiver. So, you know, there's a lot of expectations, you know, about what, you know, I could have been at quarterback or whatever I didn't become at quarterback. So now I'm just trying to, you know, be the best receiver I can be. You know, just trying to do everything on and off the field right so that, you know, I can hopefully just be the best that I can be.
David Sills joining us, not only that, but leading the nation in touchdown receptions. You know, I'm curious, like, what was that transition like? For instance, you go to West Virginia, you love the coaching staff, they fell in love with you. No matter what, they wanted you on that team, they were going to find a spot for you, and you want to play quarterback, but then you get there and you're running the option on the scout team, and the coaches were so impressed by your athleticism that they moved you to wide receiver. Initially, when that happened, what was that like, and what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I initially got moved to wide receiver on scout team, I really didn't, you know, think anything of it. I was just kind of, you know, doing it just to help the team. You know, we were a little short on the scout team. We had another quarterback, so, you know, I just went out and did it. You know, didn't think anything of it. You know, just had some fun with it. And then Coach Holgerson asked me to play receiver, you know, for a couple weeks. In the first week, I kind of just said no, like, I just want a red shirt. You know, I don't want to burn my red shirt playing receiver and everything like that. And then finally the next week, I told him I'll play and, you know, give it a go and everything like that. So, you know, it definitely took a couple weeks for me to kind of realize that this could happen, and it was, you know, a serious thing. But, you know, I'm very happy with my decision to, you know, play receiver my freshman year. And, you know, obviously last year going to a junior college and you know, trying to play quarterback again. You know, I think that was a great step for me, honestly. You know, I got all the quarterback out of my system, so the opportunity for me to, you know, come back to West Virginia and play receiver opened up. You know, me and Coach Holgerson kept a great relationship the whole time. So when I came back, I, you know, didn't really have any quarterback thoughts in my mind. You know, it was just, how can I be, you know, the best receiver that I can be? And, you know, my receiver coach, Coach Carrier, has really done a great job with teaching me the technique. You know, he's a former receiver, played with Coach Holgerson at Houston. So he's really just tried to teach me as much as he could about the technique. And I've really just tried to be like a sponge and just, you know, soak it all up. And really just take everything he's saying and try to put it on the field.
Now, it makes so much sense to me. Like, you had to find out. You came back here, you went to El Camino, you took a shot at playing quarterback, and you were really smart in the way you handled it. You never burned any bridges. You always had a great attitude. And then Daniel Holgerson did say to you, quote, "You have a home here at receiver because I think you're an NFL receiver." He told you that, and then you came back, and even you yourself have said roughly a year ago, you're out here in Cali, you're living on your buddy's couch, you're wondering what's going to happen, and now you lead the country in receiving TDs. So my question is this. A lot of people in your situation would have been angry when things did not work out at quarterback the way they had hoped, the way they had planned, yet you turn yourself into one of the best receivers in the country, which is pretty amazing. Did you ever have any moments of anger or doubt?
I mean, there was a couple of times, you know, through the recruiting process where it was getting towards the end and there was a dead period coming. And, you know, I wanted the mid-year and after that, the season of junior college, go to back to a Division I school. And, you know, it was like a week and a half or a week before the dead period happened when I was just sitting there thinking, like, you know, I don't know what I'm going to have to do. I might have to walk on somewhere. You know, what am I really going to do? Where am I going to be playing? And then it came, you know, towards the end of it, like, okay, do we say, you know, this quarterback thing is out of it and when we need to start playing, you know, start marketing yourself as a receiver? And that's kind of where it went with it towards the end. But, you know, you really didn't hear anything because it was very late in the recruiting process, you know, especially for a junior college. Well, so that was, you know, really one thing that I was thinking about. But, you know, Coach Holgerson talked to my high school coach and told him that, you know, he can come back here and play receiver. And, you know, me and Coach Holgerson had a talk just about, you know, if quarterback was fully out, you know, if it was out of my system. But, you know, he welcomed me back with, you know, open arms, you know, and I was very excited to have the opportunity to come back because, you know, he knows I loved it when I was here, loved all the teammates, coaches, you know, all the staff and everything. So when I was able to come back, you know, it really was kind of a relief to me, just knowing that I had home here and being able to, you know, come play and be at peace with my mind. So I'm not like, you know, going back and forth of thinking about if I'm playing quarterback. You know, I went to a junior college. You know, I did everything I could. It didn't work out. So, you know, I just jumped in with both feet to play receiver, honestly.
Again, the weather. It's nothing more boring than talk about the weather. There's a reason why I don't want you talking about the weather on this show. It's boring, and there's nothing anybody can do about the weather, except it is a topic today. And yes, I know before every World Series, Super Bowl, or NBA Finals, there's a story that's really a non-story that somehow becomes a story. This is not that. In fact, as I'm checking my weather app on my iPhone, where I am right now, and I'm not like adjacent to the stadium, but you know, we're down the roads away, always. It's 94 degrees right now, and it's going to get hotter. According to my weather app, at lunchtime, it's going to be 104. And then it'll carry right up until game time, where it's going to be about 98 degrees. It looks like it's not going to be as windy. But you're going to be in the high 90s when that game starts. That's hot. I mean, again, this is not SoCal complaining about the weather. Since when have people from Southern California complained about the sun? This is not us complaining, it's just stating the facts. And the facts are, it's a freaking inferno here right now. How hot? 90 and blowing a gale at 6 a.m. this morning. Think about that. Before the sun comes up, you're already sweating and blasting the AC. And if that feels a bit excessive, it's not. There is a literal excessive heat warning for the area. In other words, when it comes to game one, Mother Nature is, wait for it, bringing the heat. Now, Clayton Kershaw says he's not concerned. Quote, yeah, it's going to be hot.
It is going to be hot, but no, I mean, I don't think there's going to change anything. I think by 5, the sun will be down. And I mean, look, they're from Houston. I'm from Texas. It's going to be hot for everybody, so we're all used to it. It'll be fine.
In other words, I guess you could say that Clayton Kershaw isn't sweating it. Hey to the O! Meanwhile, Dallas Keuchel is not bothered either. Quote, it's the World Series, yo.
I mean, it's the World Series, so if it's a little bit hotter than usual, that's fine with me. There's no place I'd rather be.
Which means a lot more coming from him, because he's going to roll out to the mound with that giant sweater attached to his face. My man's got one of the thickest, most luxurious beards in Major League Baseball history. And I'll be amazed if that thing isn't 3 or 10 pounds heavier because of all the sweat. And no, he's not going to take it down before the game. He's not going to shave it. He says he'll take it down if they win the World Series, but he's not changing it now, nor should he. Keuchel and Kershaw are both horses. They're not going to complain about the thermometer the day before the biggest starts of their lives. They know the deal. This is exactly what they want. Well, except for the fact that that ball will be jumping out of the park in 90-degree weather. And if the wind does keep up and is blowing out, look the hell out, because infield pop-ups will be leaving the yard. And no, I really don't care to hear from any of you who live in Palm Springs or Death Valley or Arizona about how the expected high of 101 really isn't that hot, and how soft we are for complaining about something when it barely cracks triple digits. Yeah, I know. You live in much hotter temps. Good for you. Congratulations. But you're not hosting the World Series. And nobody has hosted the World Series in weather like this. According to John Thorne, MLB's official history, no World Series game has ever been played in a stadium without a roof above 81 degrees in the last 40 years. Well, that's definitely going to happen today, because it's supposed to be anywhere from 95 to 97 for the first pitch. Good luck. Everybody stay safe. Everybody stay hydrated. Do not go passing out on me. Signed, Van Smack, slamming coffee at 9:45 in the morning when it's 400 degrees outside and 280 inside my studio. Stay hydrated. Stay cool. Do what you have to do. 1-800-636-8686. Let's go to Arlington, Texas. Look who's there. Rada Mike. Hey, Mike, what's up? Good morning.
Good morning, Van Smack, and thanks for taking the call. It's a little outside my regular rotation, but I wanted to come in. I caught the show yesterday, first off, on the interview with Del Rio. You know, it was blatantly obvious, the disappointment, the inflection in his voice when you asked him about why Lynch ran on the field. You know, I was at the game. It was so wild, I really couldn't tell at the time, but it was evident that he meant to separate his offensive linemen from Peters. And, you know, Jim, I'm all about town business, but team business comes first. Peters took a run at our franchise quarterback, and I'll tell you, there is a lot of Raider fans unhappy with this guy. Personally, myself, I love beast mode. We are going to need him. He's been running hard, breaking tackles, moving the pile, even if he isn't putting up the numbers, you know, but it's just business. Also, Jim, hey, real quick, I caught Ira's call yesterday. You know, he didn't address your question, so I will quickly. Back in the 90s for the Clones, Dodger players would hang out at the beach in Manhattan listening to the show. You know, this is back when you came on at noon. You know, they'd come right off the sand and lob calls into the studios if they wanted to comment. I remember one day you had on Eric Karros, and for probably, Jim, the only time in your radio career, you asked a guest who their favorite callers were. So EK drops my name. I guess he liked the phone call he'd made regarding the player strike or something, upon which myself, in pure Clone fashion, later dropped a call to EK and the Dodger clubhouse scrounging for tickets. I got them. Anyway, being from Texas, hey, real quick, I've seen plenty of the Astros. They are a badass team, but I like the Dodgers. Real quick, you knew people talk about that 88 series, and all you hear them talk about is Kirk Gibson. But that was Gibson's only at-bat in the series, and it was clutch hitting by guys like Mickey Hatcher and lights-out pitching that won it for him. And I like this current Dodger team in the same fashion. I'll be there in SoCal Wednesday, Jim, one of our C-130s. It's taking the Navy Leapfrogs home after they jumped the TCU game Saturday. And, hey, if any of you Clones want to drop some Game 2 tickets my way, just DM me on Twitter. That's all I got.
Raider Mike, Raider Mike. Sean Casey is my guest. Sean, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Romy, how you doing, my man? World Series times here again.
I know it, Sean. I always love having you on this show to start the season, so I had to run you down on the day of Game 1 of the World Series. What do you make of the matchup between these two teams, Sean?
It's going to be a great World Series. I mean, I just think they match up so well. The lineups match up really well. I think, obviously, Verlander, Kershaw going Game 1, you know, two juggernauts. I think that's, you know, going to be a ton of fun. The rotations line up pretty good, obviously, with, you know, Keuchel sliding in there too. You know, I think it could come down to the battle of the bullpens. You know, what we've seen in these last few years with Andrew Miller last year, you know, a couple years earlier with Kansas City and their three-headed monster at the back end of that pen. You know, the Dodgers pen has been so dominant. It's going to be interesting to see how big of a part that comes into play if it becomes a battle of the bullpens.
All right, Sean, it's an absolute inferno here in Los Angeles today. Now, you've played in some incredibly high temps on turf back in Cincinnati in July, but this is L.A. in October. When you played with the Tigers, as an example, in 06, there was snow. So how weird is it to see a game one of the World Series with this kind of heat?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I mean, I remember when I was with the Tigers in 06 and it was snowing, I was like, okay, this is not baseball weather when it's snowing. But I tell you what, I think obviously when you go to L.A. as a player, you love the 75, 85, no humidity, sunshine, and that's all great. You're not necessarily used to the 104, but I think one thing, Romy, is that, you know, the bottom line is, you know, you played all season long in hot weather. And, you know, I think this will be, if it was freezing cold, it's one thing, but for it to be 104 degrees, not a ton of humidity. I think the weather's not going to be a huge factor because these guys grind through the season in that kind of weather anyhow.
Sean Casey joining us. Now, Sean, you and I have talked in the past about your first plate appearance against Clayton Kershaw and how that went when he dropped that curveball that Vin Scully called public enemy number one. If you were advising the Astro hitters, what would you be telling them about how to approach Kershaw?
Man, you know, Kershaw's so tough. He's just, you know, I'm so grateful I got a chance to face him, obviously, before he was Clayton Kershaw, and see the kind of stuff that he had. You know, I think Kershaw, you know, I think what's tough about him, he's got a little bit of a deceptive motion with that double leg kick. He's got a, you know, that a big four-seam fastball, and when he really works it down in the zone at the knees, he's tough because then he can go to that curveball. But if I'm going to face a guy like Clayton Kershaw, I'm trying to get him early. I'm trying to get him up in the zone. I'm trying to set my sights when a pitch I can get, but I'm trying to ambush him early, hoping I don't have to get to that curveball.
Sean Casey joining us. Now, Sean, the other day, Justin Verlander told a story about how when you joined the Tigers, when he was a rookie, he was shocked to learn that you had never been to the postseason and that it changed how he approached the postseason. What kind of conversation did you have with him at that time?
Yeah, you know what, Romy? I remember I came over, I got traded over to the Tigers from the Pirates in 06, and then we ended up going to the postseason and into the World Series. And Verlander was him and Kenny Rogers were our ace. And I just remember it was my ninth year in the big leagues, and I remember like finally making it and saying to myself, man, I took in every sight and sound I could because I hadn't ever been there, and it was my ninth year. And I remember pulling Justin Verlander aside. I said, Verly, I said, hey, man. I said, I know you think this is going to happen every year, but it doesn't. It is so hard to get to the postseason, let alone the World Series in the big leagues. And don't ever take this for granted. Like, you'll see as your career goes on, it's tough to get here. And when you do get there, and I was so glad he said it because I know now, you know, you see him in the postseason and what he's doing. I know he's taking it all in and cherishing it. As players, man, I played with a lot of guys in the big leagues that played 15 years and never played one day in a division series, let alone a World Series. So I just wanted to make sure that he always never took for granted the fact of how hard it is to get to the top of the mountain in baseball.
That's the truth. So much of it is luck, and so much of it is beyond your control. And I do want to revisit something, Sean. For the record, you hit 353 in the ALDS in 06, 333 in the ALCS, and then 529 with two home runs and five runs batted in the World Series. Now, I know the World Series did not end the way that you would have liked, but I know every single great athlete, especially, they all want to know and how they're going to measure themselves on the biggest stage. How satisfying was it for you then to show up the way you did on that big stage?
Oh, man, Romy, I look back at my career and that playoff run with the Tigers, you know, with all the great team, the team that I had with Leland, but having some success. I think for me, you grow up in your backyard as a little kid at 12 years old, and you're in the backyard and you're hitting the ball over the fence. You're saying, oh, Sean Casey homered in the World Series. And then when you actually do it, I remember when I homered off Jeff Suppan in Game 4 with my mom and dad in the stands, and my kids were in the stands, and my wife, and I remember rounding first base thinking, wow, I just did like what I thought, what I dreamt of back in when it was in Pittsburgh, PA, in my backyard, and no one can ever take it from me. And I think that's the great thing about the postseason. My kids still ask me today, what do you miss, Dad, about the game? I said, you know what I miss? You miss the opportunity to play in the postseason because there's nothing like the atmosphere. There's nothing like knowing that you've gotten there playing with those guys. And looking back at my career, the most satisfying times I had was that postseason run with the Tigers.
Sean Casey joining us for a few more moments. MLB Network is all over the World Series. Sean, from the Dodgers standpoint, what's your reaction when you see a rookie like Cody Bellinger coming into the league? He hits 39 home runs in the regular season. He continues to make an impact in the postseason. How do you explain the level of composure in such a young player?
Oh, you love it, man. You know, I think one thing with Bellinger is, you know, you think back to his dad, you know, playing in the big leagues. I played against his dad a little bit when he was with the Yankees. And you think about the mentality of a big leaguer, the mentality of, you know, the guys that get to the big leagues is one thing. The guys that get there and stay are a totally different animal. And Clay, you know, when you look at Bellinger, you really think about how he talks about, I just try and go one pitch at a time. I know that sounds so simple, Romy, and I know guys say that, but listen, at the end of the day, the guys that can go one pitch at a time are the guys that hit 40 home runs, or the guys that drive in 120, the guys that hit 300, because it's not easy to do. So when I look at Bellinger, I look at just a different mentality for such a young kid, and it's pretty impressive.
Hey, Sean, if I had to put you on the spot, who wins this series and why?
Wow, you know what? I really think it's going to be a great matchup. I really think the Dodgers. I just their team that they have, top to bottom, you know, they're back playing really good baseball. I just think that that bullpen might turn out to be the difference in these games, and I think it's going to be a good series. But I see the Dodgers maybe winning in six.
Sean, before I let you go, over the weekend, you had the Miracle League of the South Hills Halloween party. How did the party go? And did I see you in the dunk tank?
Bro, you're the best, man. Yeah, man, you did see me in the dunk take. We have Miracle League of the South Hills is our foundation, my foundation. And, yeah, we had a big Halloween party for all special needs kids, and they loved dunking me, Romy. I was in there for like 20 minutes, and thank God it was 60 degrees, 65 degrees, I think, in Pittsburgh, which is really warm for an October day here. But it was a great weekend, great time for our kids, and it's you know, just a wonderful thing. So I really appreciate you bringing that up, man.
Sean, I want to ask you really quickly, though, before you go. You and I have talked about the Miracle League in the past. How did you first get involved in it, and what is it about the league that is so special to you?
Oh, man. Well, I got involved in the Miracle League when I threw out the first pitch in a field in Cincinnati, Ohio. A friend of mine that started one, I didn't even know they existed. And I was like, this is wonderful with you know, kids with cerebral palsy, with Down syndrome. You know, we have a lot of autistic kids. My wife's youngest sister, Jenny, is special needs too, so my wife and I had always said, when we were done playing, why don't we build one? So we did. We, you know, I went and pounded. I'd never raised a dollar in my life. We ended up raising over $2 million, building a special needs playground and a special needs field. We have over 300 kids, Romy, that come, like, you know, come and play with us on the weekends. And it's just probably the coolest thing. You know, you talk about home runs in the World Series and all that stuff. Like, that was really cool. This probably ends up being, you know, the coolest thing I've ever been a part of. And, you know, it just brings me so much joy being able to see these kids play every Saturday.
We are joined by John Feinstein. John, good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks for having me, as always.
John, always look forward to it. Now, there's always the question of where an author comes up with the ideas for a book, and you've said that for you it's random, but with the first major, you actually know the exact moment. What was that moment?
Yeah, it was 1993 when I was beginning the research for A Good Walk Spoiled, which was about life on the golf tour, and I went to the Ryder Cup at the Belfry, and I was just overwhelmed by the emotion of it and the intensity of it and how the crowd was into it and the players were into it emotionally and all the great characters, Seve Ballesteros and Nick Faldo and Colin Montgomery, and Tom Watson was captain, and some of the heroes on the American side, Payne Stewart was still a major factor back then. But it came down, the matches came down to Davis Love, who was a Ryder Cup rookie then, and an Italian guy named Costantino Rocca. And I was standing on the 18th tee. The match was even. This was going to decide the whole thing with my pal Bruce Edwards, Tom Watson's caddy for many years, who you know died of ALS in 2004. And Bruce is bending over, taking deep breaths, because he's almost hyperventilating. And he said, this is the most nervous I've ever been. And I said, remember, you were with Watson in 82 when he chipped in at Pebble Beach to beat Jack Nicklaus. More nervous than that? And he said, more nervous than that. And Davis later told me that he almost got sick in the middle of the 18th fairway. He was so tense. And I said, I want to write about this someday. And I won't bore you with the details. It took me 23 years to finally get around to doing it. But I think I got the timing right, because the Ryder Cup was so dramatic at Hazeltine last year. The Americans had to win. The Europeans gave them everything they had with six rookies playing on the team. And I was able to get players on both teams to talk to me in a way that I think, as you read the book, you'll feel like you were inside both team rooms. In fact, Rory McIlroy tweeted that today, that he felt like he was in both team rooms reading the book. And that's pretty flattering coming from Rory.
It absolutely is. The book is called The First Major, the inside story of the 2016 Ryder Cup. It's out today. So, John, the emotions that you speak of, why are the emotions so charged in a Ryder Cup? Why does it mean so much to the players?
Well, part of it is because it's an individual sport, and they never get to be part of a team. And in the President's Cup is minor league. Nobody really cares about the President's Cup. Ryder Cup's been around for 90 years now, since 1927. And when it really changed, Jim, was when Jack Nicklaus suggested that it not be U.S. versus Great Britain and Ireland, but be U.S. versus Europe. And then along came Seve Ballesteros and Jose Maria Olazabal and Bernhard Langer, and all of a sudden Europe became a force to be reckoned with, and we started losing the Ryder Cup, which we'd never done before. I mean, we always won. It was like, remember the America's Cup? Nobody knew the America's Cup existed until we lost it to Australia in 1983.
Right.
Ryder Cup the same way, and the pendulum swung so far over to Europe that it was like, are we ever going to win it again? And the meltdown at Medina in 2012 really led, through a lot of twists and turns that I go through in the book, to what happened at Hazeltine in 2016.
Now, when you talk about Medina in 2012, John Feinstein joining us, how did the U.S. team respond to that loss, and then what kind of emotional scars did it leave on the players?
I think it left a lot of scars, especially on a lot of the older guys, Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, Jim Furyk, Steve Stricker, guys who'd been part, as good as their careers had been, they'd been part of so many losing Ryder Cup teams. Tiger Woods was part of one winning Ryder Cup team as a player, one, in 1999. And that's when Ted Bishop, the president of the PGA, said, we need tough love. I'm bringing Tom Watson back, who was the last American captain to win in Europe in that 1993 Ryder Cup at the Belfry. And the players did not respond well to Watson. And, you know, you can put blame on both sides, but Phil Mickelson told me he from day one he thought it was a bad choice. Well, if you've already made up your mind, it's hard to play well for a captain or a coach or a manager, whomever it might be. And we got dusted over there. And then there was the whole Mickelson-Watson takedown at the final night press conference. And the thing about it was Watson said, we need to play better, which was apparent. Europe made 135 birdies. The U.S. made 90. But Phil took that as an insult that he's saying we didn't try, which Watson will tell you that was absolutely not what he was saying. But he went off on Watson, and even though I think his timing was bad, that was not the time or the place right after Europe had played so well to bring all that stuff up, it did lead to the task force, which even though a lot of people made fun of it, for good reason, that really helped the U.S. at Hazeltine because they had the right captain, they had the right preparation, and they had the right attitude.
John Feinstein joining us. The first major inside the story of the 2016 Ryder Cup is out today. So, John, what about the approach going into the 2016 Ryder Cup? How different then was the approach for the Americans?
Well, it was a lot different. For one thing, Davis Love stepped out of character. I know you know Davis. He's one of the nicest men in sports. But he stepped away from that. He created the old-fashioned us-versus-them mentality in the team room. Everybody who wasn't part of the Ryder Cup, either present or past, was them. The guys who were was us. And that's why the whole thing between David Duval and Brandel Chambly became a big deal to the American team.
John, lay that out. Let me jump in if you don't mind. John, lay that out for me, exactly what happened. For those who don't remember or don't know, Duval and Brandel Chambly had a heated debate on the Golf Channel. What happened?
Of why the U.S. has failed so often, losing 8 of 10 Ryder Cups. And Chambly says you got to put it on the leaders. The leaders have been Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson. They failed. And Duval, who played on two Ryder Cup teams and was one of the few guys who was actually friendly with Tiger when he was still playing regularly, said, no, that's 100% wrong. And they got into this 9-minute and 54-second heated debate. Well, the American team was all watching this back in the team room at the hotel. And they were literally cheering Duval on. So Davis Love saw an opportunity, and he asked Duval to come to the team room when he was off TV. And when Duval walked in, the entire team gave him a standing ovation because he was standing up for us. And Chambly, because he good player, Brandel, on tour, but never a Ryder Cup player, was them. And it didn't matter who was right or who was wrong. He was standing up for us. And that was a big deal to those guys, and it was a bonding thing for those guys. And you know what the biggest difference in the American team room was, Jim? You're going to laugh at me. It was ping pong. Because for years, the American guys, when they weren't close and they weren't bonded, would come, oh, we're playing ping pong. We're having a great time, and you should see Tiger and Phil playing ping pong together. Well, that's because they didn't want to talk to one another.
Right.
This year, Matt Kuchar, who's the best ping pong player on the team, told me nobody played ping pong all week because they were enjoying one another's company. That was a huge marker if you were trying to figure out why the Americans played so well.
John Feinstein joining us. Once again, the book is called The First Major, Inside the Story of the 2016 Ryder Cup. It is out today. John, what about, from a leadership standpoint, what about Jordan Spieth? How important was he to that team?
It's a great question because Jordan was one of the youngest guys on the team, but he's also needed to be one of the leaders because he was one of the best players. And both Davis Love and Phil Mickelson pushed him early in the week saying, you've got to take a leadership role on this team. You've got to let the guys know, you know, come and follow me. And Jordan, who thinks about everything, you know, Jordan doesn't order a salad without thinking about it, thought about it for 3 days. And finally, his girlfriend, Annie Verrett, said, don't write anything out. Don't plan anything. Just get up and speak from your heart to your teammates. And on Thursday night after dinner, he did that. And he talked about how much he believed in them and that he thought they could win every match. He said, I don't think our goal should be to get to 14.5. Our goal should be to get to 28, to try to win every match because we're capable of it. And I believe in you guys. And Patrick and I, Patrick Reed, his partner, we're going to lead you out there tomorrow. We're going to set the pace, and you follow us. And Mickelson and Love individually both said to me, when I said, what was your most important moment off the golf course? They both said that was it. Because Jordan had to be the guy to say, forget about the past, forget about the losses, I'm here now, we're a new team, follow me. And of course, the U.S. went out the next day, as you know, and took a 4-0 lead with Spieth and Reed leading the way.
John Feinstein joining us. Now, John, the first major is out today, another tremendous book. But on top of that, you also released Backfield Boys. It's a young adult mystery about a couple of kids who play football at a prep school that is similar to IMG Academy. Lay this out for me. Who are these two kids, and what is the dynamic at that school?
Well, the funny thing about this book is, Jim, I started writing it a year ago, right when the Colin Kaepernick story was beginning to unfold. And I've always felt, you and I have talked about this in the past, that race is very much the elephant in the room, both in sports and even more so in our country. And I had no idea what was going to happen in Charlottesville at that moment. I had no idea what was going to go on between Trump and the NFL players. But I did know that race was an issue. So I created these two characters, as you said, two kids, white kid, black kid from New York. The African-American kid is a gifted quarterback. They go to this fictional prep school right outside of Charlottesville, in an ironic twist, as it turned out. And the coach is an old-time, you know, coach who thinks that an African-American isn't smart enough to play quarterback. So he puts Tom at wide receiver, and he puts Jason at quarterback, even though Jason's very fast, another stereotype buster, I guess, and a great wide receiver. The boys are confused by this. They don't understand why the coach is doing this. They begin investigating, and they come to find out he's never had an African-American play quarterback, first, second, or third string. And then they learn subsequently that the head of their school, the guy who founded the school, is a former KKK member. Now, I made that up when I wrote it, Jim, but I had no idea there was going to be reality behind it when the book was about to come out this summer.
You know, John, I mean, you and I have talked about these issues for a long, long time. You've covered sports for a long, long time. What kind of a role do athletes have when it comes to addressing racial and social issues? And then what's your reaction when you hear folks say, I come to sports to avoid politics and social issues? I mean, can you separate these things out?
Jim, in a utopian world, that's the way it would be. You know, we'd go to games and there would just be games, and the biggest argument would be about whether you should have called run or pass on third and four. But in the real world, it's never been that way. Adolf Hitler and Jesse Owens in 1936, Avery Brundage not running two Jewish runners in the relay, including the great Marty Glickman, because he didn't want to, quote, insult Hitler. 1968, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who were ripped for doing what they did on the medal stand. 1972, the Munich Massacre. I mean, it goes on and on, Jim. Sports is part of politics. Politics is part of sports at times. We don't want it to be that way, but it almost always is that way.
Hey, John, are you playing the drums or is somebody else?
Jim, forgive my daughter in the background.
Yeah, I thought somebody was playing the drums.
That's my daughter.
That's all right.
She's playing her older brother's drums.
She's good. She's good.
She's talented.
Yeah, she has potential. I can hear it. Hey, John, will your daughter take requests?
I'm sorry. Wait 1 second.
Bridget! Stop.
I apologize.
Let's go to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Ron, you made it in under the wire. Hi, Ron. How are you?
What's up, Romy? How are you doing?
Good. How about you, Ron?
It's actually Ryan. I didn't want to clarify it.
It's not Ron, it's Ryan.
That's not a good call. No.
Why'd you do that, Alex?
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
Why'd you do that?
Not a very good call.
Why'd you do that, Alvin? Alvin, that was not his fault. That was Hawk's fault. Why'd you do that? Why did you run a guy when we got his name wrong? Alvin. It's not Ron, it's Ryan. Alvin's explanation for running him. I mean, I just asked hypothetically, rhetorically, why did you do that? Well, he answered the question. Alvin's response, can you run that back one more time, what we just did to that guy? You ran a guy. He ran him for correcting us on his name. All right, exactly what did that guy do wrong? We got his name wrong, and all he did was politely correct us, and Alvin dropped the hammer. Alvin, can I hear that back? Let's go to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Ron, you made it in under the wire. Hi, Ron. How are you?
What's up, Romy? How are you doing?
Good. How about you, Ron?
It's actually Ryan. I didn't want to clarify it.
It's not Ron, it's Ryan.
That's not a good call. No.
Why'd you do that, Alvin?
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
Why'd you do that?
Not a very good call.
So when I asked Alvin why he ran a guy who did nothing but correct us for getting his name wrong, Alvin's first response was, it was just a reflex. And then his second response was, the host is never wrong, just go with it. The host is never wrong. Alvin, quote, the host is never wrong. Just go with it. Nobody cares. Ron, Ryan, whatever. Alvin, you are the man. Give yourself a tongue. Rack yourself, Alvin. That is so funny. Alvin ran a guy for merely correcting us for getting his name wrong. Hi, Ron. How are you?
What's up, Romy? How are you doing?
Good. How about you, Ron?
It's actually Ryan. I didn't want to clarify it.
It's not Ron. It's Ryan. That's not a good call. No. Why'd you do that, Alvin?
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
Why did you do that, Alvin? I don't know, bro. It's just a reflex. Whenever I see a caller try and correct us when I know we're probably right and they're wrong, I just run them. Yeah, but it was his name, and we got it wrong. Yeah, I don't know why I find this so amusing, but I find this very amusing. I got news for you, Ryan. You're wrong now. So when you call this show, you best tell us you're Ron, or we're going to correct you. Stop correcting us about your name, Ron. Come on, Ron. Like, the guy self-glossed himself, Ryan. He self-glossed himself his real name. Hey, by the way, guys, I'm not glossing myself anything. That's my freaking name. It's my government. My name is Ryan. No, it's not. It's Ron. When you call this show, you best be Ron. Hey, Ron, I'd apologize because I certainly owe you one. Not as much as Alvin owes you one, but it's too funny, so we're not going to apologize. You're Ron. If it'll make you feel better, I'll rack you. I damn near gave you a golden ticket, Ron. Thank you so much for listening to the Daily Jungle and to the Jim Rome Podcast. Episode 10 drops shortly. Trust the podcast. Check back here tomorrow for more Daily Jungle. See you then. I'm out.